Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. We hope you had an amazing 2019. It certainly has been crazy. And we are looking forward to bringing you more great shows in 2020. On today's show, you're going to hear a fresh interview with Robert Kuttner from The American Prospect, where he lays out an urgent plan for climate change or dealing with climate change and how radical change is needed to prevent the destruction of really of our society and civilization as we know it. We'll also look back at our series of interviews with Democratic candidates around the country who are challenging incumbents in an effort to bring progressive policies to the forefront. Let's begin with Robert Kuttner from The American Prospect, who joined me last week to discuss the Green New Deal and how a radical shift in policy is needed to combat climate change. So, Robert, let's just talk about why you folks over at The Prospect decided to write, well, not just to write your piece, obviously, but we're talking over 20 essays that deal with the implications of implementing and the reasons behind, I guess, and the political arguments and the how-to, if you will, of implementing the Green New Deal. What was the idea? To basically provide a blueprint in the event that a Democratic, progressive Democrat wins in 2020?
Well, it was two things. First of all, yes, we wanted to provide a blueprint. But secondly, we wanted to use this blueprint to make the case that a Green New Deal, which has been disparaged as utopian, is actually quite practical. When AOC embraced the Green New Deal brand last year, there were already about 20 reports kicking around with different versions of a Green New Deal. And hers became a kind of lightning rod for both the center and the right to attack as too much money and too utopian and it's not achievable. In fact, if you use the original New Deal as a model and you cost out what it actually would require to get to zero carbon by 2040 or 2050 and cost out what a very serious infrastructure program would look like, it's remarkably achievable. I mean, we had two of the best economists who study this stuff in the country costing this out, Jeff Sachs and Bob Polin. And they agree, and Polin is rather further to the left than Sachs, they agree you can do this for about 2% of GDP. Now, you compare that with World War II, where we spent about 43% of GDP per year to prosecute World War II, most of whose fruits were blown up. So this is doable. The cost of not doing it, of course, is astronomical. And we wanted to demonstrate that this brand was not tarnished, that this way of thinking about dealing with global climate change and turning it into an economic winner as well as an environmental winner was very achievable. It was achievable technically, is achievable fiscally, and then we focused on the politics. How do you make this achievable politically? And so we lined up the best writers we could find on the subject, and we addressed the part of the Green New Deal that involves getting to zero carbon. We address the part of the Green New Deal that involves massive infrastructure investment to modernize decaying infrastructure. And then the third part of the package is on the politics of how you get this done politically, how you build an environmental justice component into it, how you build a coalition to get it done.
So let me ask you this. I mean, as far as, and I want to go through how you outline it in your piece, which introduces the entire vertical, I guess we could call it. But where do you put the relative, I guess, questions of, and I think to a large extent, you know, this project that you have over at the Prospect argues the political feasibility and the practical, pragmatic benefits of a Green New Deal. How much more work needs to be done, can be done? Is it worthwhile to do even trying to make people aware of the urgency, right? Like there's two ends of this. It's one is that it's not as hard as people make it out to be. And the other one is we need to do it. and I don't think these two things are mutually exclusive necessarily, but I'm curious as to where you think we are in how much, you know, where the emphasis needs to be placed at this point.
We did not waste a lot of ink or a lot of electrons demonstrating the urgency of dealing with climate change. You know, every time another report comes out, we are closer and closer to the point where climate change is irreversible, where the cumulative interaction of various systems feed on each other. And I think the scientific community has done that to a fairly well. That was the one part of the project that did not bear repeating. I think there is complacency in the sense that, you know, unless you live in a coastal community that is subject to daily flooding, as some of Florida and some of Virginia are, or unless you're in the path of a forest fire, it's too easy to just say, I know intellectually that in 10 or 20 years, things are going to be a lot worse. But for the moment, life goes on. So it isn't just hardcore climate change deniers. It's regular people for whom, despite the fact that we're going to have food shortages at some point, right now prices in the grocery store have not gone up. And in most cities, it's hotter in the summer and maybe colder in the winter, but doesn't feel that abnormal. We did not feel, given all the reports that have been written, all the books that have been written, that it was our job to just do one more piece or series of pieces on just how alarming this is. We just take that as kind of a baseline. Where we felt the value added we could contribute was to demonstrate that this is a lot more feasible than you think it is. It's feasible technically, it's feasible politically, and it will not require belt tightening. It may require a change in how we define the good life, but we felt very strongly that the idea that we have to sell ordinary people on the proposition that they have to tighten their belts was a complete non-starter, given that 80 or 90% of Americans have been tightening their belts for 30 or 40 years. And it's not that we want to promote frivolous consumption, but we believe that affordable housing that doesn't consume as much energy, reliable public transit, reliable cheaper electricity that can then be used for all vehicle transport and all home heating, that represents an improvement in living standards, not a decay in living standards.
And so this is the and you set it up in your piece as squaring the circle of really three separate areas. And the first one deals with just that, this notion of that often we hear the Green New Deal associated with the degrowth movement, if you will, or people who desire to sort of and you basically say that is not it is not basically the best terrain to fight on. And in many respects, it's not actually true.
Well, you know, I know people who believe in voluntary simplicity, if you will, who believe that it's personally virtuous as well as environmentally necessary to live at a much, much lower standard of living. And that's their personal choice. I think as a politics, it's a non-starter. Go out into a black neighborhood where workers never got to be part of the carbon gravy train in the first place, or go out into a white working class neighborhood where people who have jobs in the carbon economy are losing their jobs, or just go out to middle America where living standards have been cratering for three or four decades and tell people, oh, I got news for you. Because of the climate crisis, you're going to have to tighten your belts. I mean, for better or for worse, this is still something of a democracy. And you have to get political buy-in. You have to get political support of the citizenry if you're going to enact a climate change program. So to advertise the benefit of a climate change program as, well, guess what? You get to lower your living standards. That's just not going to happen. And although there's a kind of missionary quality to people who think that degrowth is just something we have to persuade other folks of, I think there's a political unreality to it. Doesn't mean that we
should give up on the need to reduce the total material toll on the planet. Yes, we absolutely do. But that doesn't mean that we have to reduce perceived living standards for regular people. It means we got to tax rich people. It means we've got to go after a lot of frivolous luxury consumption. But I think it's a non-starter to tell people that, guess what, you get to tighten your belts.
All right. Well, we need to take a break. When we come back, let's talk more about the other circles that need to be squared. One that has to do with speed, and the other has to do with the relationship between the radicalism and basically radicals and liberals in terms of working this through the system to get it done. We got to take a quick break. I'm talking to Robert Kuttner from the Prospect, American Prospect. We'll be right back after this. Back on Ring of Fire Radio, I'm Sam Seder. We're listening to my interview with the American Prospect's Robert Kuttner about his piece, Green New Deal, The Urgent Realism of Radical Change. So, Robert, in the first segment, we were talking about the Green New Deal and this project that you have over at the American Prospect, over 20 essays that really lay out the practical arguments for the Green New Deal and the practical arguments on how to execute and legislate and get the thing passed. And we mentioned that the Green New Deal should be sold not on not as a degrowth concept, but rather as a slight change in lifestyle that ultimately will be more beneficial for people. And you also touched on the idea of in the New Deal, part of this that got through, or the mechanism that delivered these benefits to people, was really what we called pork barrel politics. Just walk us through that a little bit, and
sure.
Let's talk about the idea of speed and tie that into the second circle that you square, which is actually shovel ready projects.
Yes, and let's stay on the first item for a moment longer. I'm not saying that we can get away without drastic changes in the nature of the economy. But, you know, from the point of view of the individual, if I want to heat my house, if I can get my house in the dead of winter to a comfortable temperature, whether those electrons are generated by renewable sources or whether they're generated by filthy carbon sources, I don't notice that in my lived experience. All I know is that I'm getting electricity and then my house is warm.
Right.
So a lot of the changes that are necessary to save the planet don't necessarily translate into drastic changes in the lived experience of most people. Now, one of the things that the original New Deal did was it invested a lot of money in infrastructure, public works, as they were known in those days. And those in turn created a lot of jobs. And then, of course, we doubled down on that in World War II. And the project of rebuilding systems of the electrical grid and high-speed rail and ordinary commuter rail and dedicated bus lanes and electric cars and all of that, these generate decent jobs. A lot of these are blue-collar jobs. And so there is a jobs and infrastructure program here that will be very beneficial to the economy, very beneficial to working people. The whole notion of a just transition, where people who did work in the old carbon economy, we need to make them whole so that they get decent jobs in the new economy. And we need to get it done, some of it at least, relatively quickly. Because if the Green New Deal is seen as something that's pie in the sky, that doesn't deliver benefits, before you know it, it's the election of 2022, it's the midterm, the Republicans are ridiculing Democrats for having grandiose plans and not having delivered very much, Democrats lose their working majority and the game's over. So I think it would be good if states that are sympathetic to this got projects identified and permitted so that as soon as Green New Deal legislation were enacted by Congress, there would be tens of billions, hundreds of billions of dollars worth of programs that were shovel ready. that would start demonstrating benefits in the first year of a new administration. One of the problems in the United States is that public projects seem to take forever. And one of the biggest reasons why they take forever is not the Davis-Bacon Act. It's not environmental impact statements. It's not because citizens are involved in the planning. It's because of stop-and-go funding. And if you can get that funding locked in for 5 or 10 years, and it's federal funding, whether the actual level of the project's implementation is state or local or federal, you can get projects up and running and not waste a lot of time and a lot of money on stop-start funding, which is the illness that pervades so much of public work spending in the U.S.
Okay, we have about 3 minutes left. Let's turn to the last element that you think is crucial for the Green New Deal to basically come into existence. And that is, one, like you described, you got to do it quick so that it can build up some internal momentum so that people can see that it's actually delivering. And to a large extent, the delay in the ACA is, I think, instructive. And the failure of the stimulus bill under Obama in 2009 is instructive. But also what needs to happen is this sort of delicate dance that involves a certain amount of patience and understanding, but within a specific dynamic between liberals and you can call them socialists or democratic socialists or radicals. That dance needs to be, I guess, finely tuned in some way.
Well, you see this throughout American history, right? The original abolitionists were radicals, but it took Lincoln and it took Congress to abolish slavery. The best labor organizers are radicals, but it took Roosevelt and Congress to pass the Wagner Act. The people who sat in and sat down and marched for civil rights were radicals in the very best sense of the word, and yet it took Lyndon Johnson to get the Civil Rights Acts through Congress. So by the same token, the fact that the Green New Deal and leaders like AOC have inspired millions of young people to get on the march and form a movement, that's great. That's the kind of prod that the establishment needs. And at the same time, the establishment, or at least a working majority in Congress, needs to get the thing through Congress. And so the radicals need to have a little bit of patience with the liberals. The radicals may not get every single thing they want in the first year, but the thing about the original New Deal and the hopefulness in a Green New Deal is that success can build on success. And it doesn't all happen in the first 100 days. Even Roosevelt did not get the whole New Deal done in the first 100 days. But if you can get a good head start and a good head of steam, then it builds on itself. And there's a very nice piece in our package by Jeff Foe on how you can use government success to restore faith in government. I mean, we're asking people at a time when faith in government's ability to accomplish anything is at an all-time low to put trust in the premise that government can be trusted to spend trillions and trillions of dollars. So that's going to also be a heavy lift, and it's not going to be done all at once, but this is the most ambitious, audacious use of federal planning, federal money, federal investment since the original New Deal.
Well, folks can head over to the to prospect.org, check out the American Prospect, read all 22, I think it is, essays, maybe 23, if I'm counting correctly, that lays this out. This is going to be an important blueprint if, knock on wood, the next president is a progressive Democrat who is willing to pick up this mantle and run with it. Robert Kuttner, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Sam. Thanks for having me.
Robert Kuttner is the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect. He is a professor at Brandeis University's Heller School. His latest book, The Stakes, 2020 and the Survival of American Democracy. Coming up, we'll look back on interviews we recorded with some of the best progressive candidates from around the country challenging stale incumbents. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. This year, we've created a series to spotlight progressive candidates running against stale incumbents from around the country. Most of these candidates are challenging long-term incumbents, like I say, in order to bring progressive policy to the forefront and, frankly, affecting the politics that exist today, not only before they have actually won any elections, but pulling existing incumbents to the left to avoid this primary challenge. Let's listen to some of these interviews now. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. This week, we begin our interview series with candidates around the country running against established Democrats who do not necessarily represent progressive values held by their constituents. Our first interview is with Shahid Buttar, who is running against Speaker Nancy Pelosi in California's 12th District. So, Shahid, there is obviously, you know, a lot of questions. I imagine that you come across some measure of skepticism in some quarters as to why you would be challenging Nancy Pelosi, both in terms of she's obviously rather well-funded, but also many people have a perception of her that in the context of the Democratic Party, that she's progressive. I think people would say, you know, she was originally a member of the Progressive Caucus. Why are you primarying her from the left?
I'm primarying Speaker Pelosi from the left because, as the Democratic Speaker of the House, unfortunately, she all too often supports conservative policies and conservative figures. She protects the president, a criminal president, from impeachment. She's funded voluntarily, without being coerced in any way, Trump's concentration camps without securing any protections for human rights. She's insisted upon Republican fiscal austerity rules that constrain the progressive aspirations of the emerging House majority. The largest caucus in the House, the Congressional Progressive Caucus, is one that she co-founded. Yet she consistently turns a deaf ear to that caucus's interests. Speaker Pelosi is a avowed opponent of universal health care. She derides robust solutions to the mounting global climate crisis. She presided over a historical collapse in federal spending on affordable housing. She helped sweep CIA torture under the rug. She funded Bush's wars. I could go on, but the reputation she has as a progressive is entirely undeserved by today's standards. She may have been a progressive by yesterday's standards, and I appreciate and applaud the work that she's done over the course of her 30-year career. But if there is anything that is increasingly clear with every passing day in our country, it is that we need a transition in leadership generationally to people who are more acquainted with the experience of working people, to people who are more concerned about the future and the various mounting environmental, constitutional, international crises that the failed leadership of the past continues, unfortunately, to create and fester instead of fixing. And that's why I'm here.
So let's talk about a couple of those. I know that you took a tour of one of these concentration camps down at the border with children. And we should say that you're specifically referencing $4.9 billion bill that is funding theoretically the expansion and providing resources to house children to basically imprison them. There were progressive defectors
to illegally imprison them. I mean, that's a thing worth noting, is that we have no authority to detain these people, right? This is an illegal enterprise from the outset that Speaker Pelosi could have defunded, like she could have defunded Bush's illegal wars. But at every opportunity to support a military-industrial complex, even when it undermines human rights, again, unfortunately, Speaker Pelosi has not been on the side of this city. She's instead represented the Beltway in Washington.
Why do you think that message has not gotten out? And or let me rephrase that. To what extent do you think your message is getting out? Yeah, well, I mean, honestly, I mean, because I think that, like, listen, we are living in a different era now, as you say. And for many, many years, those of us on the left have been told this is the best we can do. I have ideas. You know, Barack Obama famously said, you know, if we had a different situation in America, we could have Medicare for all. He said that back in 2008. He's since said a different thing in 2018, that it's an idea whose time has come. But at that time, you know, we are always told on the left that we are proposing, by many in the Democratic Party, we are proposing as much as the as left as we can go. But that has shifted, and it does seem like Nancy Pelosi has not shifted along with it. To what extent do you think that message is that people understand that concept? And then to the extent that anybody doesn't in your district, how will you let them know that?
Yeah, our message is certainly out there, and I wouldn't even say it's taken me to deliver it. I've only half-jokingly said publicly that Speaker Pelosi appears to be campaigning on my behalf recently, and it's very much to the point that you're making. She is revealing the relative conservatism implicit in her not just policy and not just her representation or her rhetoric, but just her entire paradigm, as you were reflecting. You know, the progressives of today are much bolder than those who preceded us. And what you're ultimately reflecting on, and I think what the body politic is only now starting to understand beyond the context of Bernie Swick 2016, beyond the context of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in 2018, is that we are living through a generational transition in American politics. And it will be an earthquake. By the time it is done, the boomers will be gone. The millennials are already the largest generational voting bloc. And that's why Bernie did so well in 2016. It's why he'll be the next president. It's why Speaker Pelosi's career is nearing its end. And it's why I'm increasingly poised to replace her. In terms of how do we get the message out across the district, it's a combination of ground game, traditional media engagement, the conversation we're having now, as well as very robust social media outreach. And our ground game is stronger than it ever got in 2018. In 2018, I got as many votes as Representative Ocasio-Cortez did in her primary in 3 months without any media attention. We have a full year this time. We're getting media attention. We have nearly daily mobilizations, hundreds of volunteers. There are signs up all over the city, and we're still a year out from the election. So I have a great deal of confidence that unless Speaker Pelosi recovers a willingness to represent the district, which is to say if she continues representing the Beltway first, she will number her own days in the House. And I'm very eager, certainly, to offer the voters of San Francisco an alternative. And having received the support, we're at 4,000 donors now from across the city, across the Bay Area, the state, and even the entire country. We're increasingly poised to liberate the seat. That's exactly what I plan to do.
It's interesting because I think to a certain extent, there was a parody of Nancy Pelosi developed by the right and was, and frankly, I don't think it was terribly successful, at least not recently. Maybe it was more so back in the day, but nevertheless, the sort of the corruption of the Bush administration still brought her to the speakership. But there was a parody of Nancy Pelosi based upon the idea of San Francisco, that she represented San Francisco politics, and presumably that was the right using homophobia as some type of tool, as a dog whistle. And what's interesting is that, and I don't want to overstate this, but the electoral salience of like the question of marriage equality seems to be essentially gone. I don't want to say that there is that homophobia is in any way eradicated or the desire for people to turn back the clock is eradicated.
But after the Obergefell decision, it's off the table, right? It's been constitutionally decided by the Supreme Court.
Yes, and it's, you know, knock on wood, they don't get another seat and they don't start revisiting settled law. But regardless, at this point, it no longer has the salience. And I wonder if, to a certain extent, progressives bought into the right-wing frame and just simply assume that Nancy Pelosi is representing their interests. But let's take a break here. And when we come back, I want to talk about some specifics about Nancy Pelosi. You mentioned a reference to PAYGO. I want to talk about that and what the implications are. And then I want to talk about the relevance of this. I want to get a little more deeply into the relevance of this race to people outside of your district. Obviously, there's two different constituencies when we're talking about Nancy Pelosi as to why your candidacy is so important. I am Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back with Shahid Buttar in just a moment after this. We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now, I'm talking to Shahid Buttar about his primary challenge to Speaker Nancy Pelosi, California's 12th congressional district. So, Shahid, in the last segment, you basically outlined for us both your strategy going forward. You made a point of reminding us that this is your second race against Nancy Pelosi. last time with virtually no resources, no time. You got into the race late. You had a formidable showing, garnering as many votes as AOC did in her primary against Joe Crowley. Of course, we know how that ended. And now you have a year to ramp up in your battle with Nancy Pelosi. Now, there's a lot of people out there, I imagine, who are from San Francisco who are saying, you know, the set of issues for people in San Francisco is not identical to the set of issues, or I should say is more expansive maybe than the set of issues for people outside of the district who might be interested in this race. Is there a delineation in your mind? I mean, because it's not, you're running against someone in the leadership of the Democratic Party. This is not like you're running for, you know, a seat anywhere else, frankly, in the country.
Yeah, that's right. Here in San Francisco, just to be clear, I don't think any progressives are under the illusion that Speaker Pelosi is supporting progressive interests. I think that's an illusion that only gets projected outside the district by the national press. But here locally, anyone who would describe themselves as progressive would see her as an enabler of the Trump administration, if only because we watch her more closely, I think, than many people around the country. But as we look at the delineation among the issues, Medicare for all and the need to establish health care as a human right in the United States and join the rest of the civilized world is a priority for people across the country. And I think it's an urgent national priority. It's also an urgent priority for people here in San Francisco. The Green New Deal and the need to address the not looming anymore, but the mounting global climate crisis that is now upon us, that is already killing Californians. Last year, dozens of Californians died in a set of wildfires that were exacerbated by climate chaos that the prior generation of policymakers effectively contrived by deferring the fossil fuel extraction, by runaway corporate extractive capitalism, and a military-industrial complex that has been hell-bent on, quote, opening new markets around the world, which is to say plundering their natural resources to support Wall Street. I present a very different alternative than that. As an immigrant whose family lost our house when I was 16, I have understood what the empire looks like from underneath the boot. And that's unfortunately an experience that more and more people have had to experience. Here in San Francisco, another of the issues that's really crucial that I think is also crucial around the country is affordable housing. We have among the most acute crises in housing costs in any city in the country. And I was just in Atlanta for the Democratic Socialists of America conference, and I learned there that in Atlanta, there is an urban housing crisis. There's an urban housing crisis around the country. At the same time, as many rural and ex-urban communities are suffering from a depopulation as you know, urbanization continues. And in that context, I think the interest here in San Francisco in reviving federal spending on affordable housing, which has collapsed over the last 20 years, maps very closely to an increasingly widely shared national experience. So whether it's Medicare for all, whether it's the Green New Deal, whether it's affordable housing, whether it's dismantling mass incarceration and mass surveillance, these are all issues that I'm very committed to that Speaker Pelosi, unfortunately, you know, problems that she has helped create along with the rest of her class of corporate Democrats allied with corporate Republicans on too many issues. And I and the squad, for instance, and other people that are emerging from the body politic, particularly from younger generations, we aim to present a very sharp difference that is grounded in the experience of the American people instead of the imperial aspirations of a military-industrial complex whose architect warned us to fear it.
What's fascinating about what's happening in this era is that we are seeing in a way that we haven't seen in the past. I mean, because if you go back 10, 15 years ago, there were movements to primary various Democrats. For the most part, those primaries were geared towards people who were clearly, you know, ideologically, you know, across a huge divide, right? Like the Dan Lipinskis or the Henry Cuellars, who are also, yeah, incidentally, getting primaried this round. But what we're also seeing is serious challenges. And I think, you know, at least in part in the wake of AOC defeating Crowley, but also, I mean, just as a function of, like you say, there's a new generation of Democrats with a clear, more distinct ideology that is more reminiscent of the Democrats from, you know, the early 60s and during FDR's time. And
it's rooted in our experience, right? I mean, in 2008, when the global financial crisis happened and Democrats teamed up with Republicans to bail out Wall Street and basically throw students and working families to the wolves, that was a point at which, and, you know, people were saying at the time that the Occupy movement failed. And part of why Bernie's going to be the next president, the reason why AOC is in Congress, and the reason why I'm about to replace Nancy Pelosi in the House is because we didn't actually fail. It was just a long fuse. And what we are witnessing now is the maturation of a political generation that, frankly, got screwed so badly by the bipartisan corporate rule that we are not having it anymore. You know, that same stale consensus on corporate rule, that's what created Trump, because it so poorly served working families. It so dramatically exposed Americans across the political and economic spectrum to mounting crises, whether crises in police violence, in food security and availability, the climate crisis, like I mentioned, and, you know, weather events of increasing severity and consistency. It's the failure of the past that is driving that radicalization of young people and older people. I think, you know, we see in the president's demagoguery a dire need for Democrats to show up and actually mount the so-called resistance that they've been encouraging the rest of us to demonstrate. I've been resisting corporate administrations from both the Democratic and the Republican Party for 20 years. I know what resistance is, and what Speaker Pelosi is offering us is nothing of the sort.
All right, Shahad, we have just a little bit, about a minute left here. And let me just, frame this question with copping to, in the past, perceiving these incidences of and I think there's a clear-cut difference here in terms of what Pelosi is doing, but in terms of, like, marshaling resources. But I have come to believe, like, when we see Jerry Nadler getting primaried, that it is seriously given him a stronger incentive to pursue impeachment. And then when we see people like Richard Neal being primaried, it gives him more of an incentive to go after Donald Trump's tax returns. These are the way that politicians work. I don't have an ability to assess your chances of winning at this point. I think that there are actually stranger things have certainly happened, and you've certainly proven in the last race. With about 30 seconds left, I mean, how much do you anticipate this is going to put pressure on Nancy Pelosi? And why is that a reason for people to support your candidacy?
I've helped make impossible things real before. You know, I filed one of the first, you talked about marriage equality earlier. I filed the first marriage equality case in the state of New York in 2004. It was about a decade before Pelosi showed up to support the rights of my neighbors. And nobody thought we were going to win that struggle. And we did.
Yep.
I understand how the future depends on the decisions that we make today. And I fully intend to liberate the seat. And I'll just put it this way. If Pelosi doesn't show up for human rights or universal health care or affordable housing or impeachment, she numbers her own days. And she will either show up for the district's interests or she'll be replaced. It's that simple.
Shahad, how can people get more information about your candidacy?
Folks can check out our campaign at www.shahidforchange.us or on any of the major social media platforms, Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter at Shahid for Change.
Shahid, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for bringing me on, Sam.
You can find out more about Shahid's campaign at shahidforchange.us. That's Shahid, S-H-A-H-I-D, for change.us. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Last week, we began our interview series with primary candidates around the country running against established Dems who do not necessarily represent the progressive values held by their constituents or, frankly, us here at Ring of Fire Radio. This week we feature Mondaer Jones, who's primarying Nita Lowey for New York's 17th Congressional District seat. So, Mondaer, why don't you just first give us a sense of, and we should say that this we're talking to you in the context of a series that we're doing of folks who are challenging sitting Democrats in primaries. And this has been, you know, a kinetic topic, particularly since AOC unseated the one of the members of the Democratic leadership, and that has had a lot of very positive effects, I think people feel, for progressives. Give me a sense of why you decided to enter into this race.
I decided to enter into this race because people in my district are struggling. You have folks like my grandmother, folks of a different generation who are working well past the age of retirement just to pay for the high cost of prescription drugs and medical procedures. You got people like my mother when I was growing up, at least, who worked multiple jobs just to make ends meet, even with the help of the Section 8 housing voucher. And then you have people in my generation. I'm 32 years old, and so many people I know around my age who still live in this district are living at home with their parents because they can't afford to pay rent or to pay for the high cost of buying a home. And we have someone in Congress, and in fact, many members of the Democratic caucus, unfortunately, who are not fighting hard enough for the big policy items that are going to address those problems, like Medicare for All, a Green New Deal, student debt forgiveness. And in addition to not fighting for that, they're not holding this president accountable. I mean, I'm running against someone for whom I have great respect. She's the chair of the House Appropriations Committee. But if I were in her role, I would not have given $7.6 billion to ICE. I would not have had to be challenged for the first time in 30 years before I reversed my position on the issue of impeachment. And I would have fought to give tax relief under the SALT cap deduction to the folks in this district who pay the highest property taxes in the entire country. So I think we can walk and chew gum. It's not just about challenging Republicans. We can challenge ourselves to do better as a Democratic Party. And, you know, my responsibility is raising the expectations of people in this district of their leaders.
So tell me a little bit about New York's 17th congressional district, just so that folks around the country can take to get a notion of it and what they should be expecting from a congressman from a New York district.
This district is a district in which I was born and raised. I live in Nyack, which is in the county of Rockland. That's about 40% of the district. The other 60% is comprised of parts of central and northern Westchester. And this is a working class district. Median household income is $95,000, so it's a little more affluent than many other districts, but still working class and middle to upper middle class. And folks here are people who are progressive Democrats for the most part, especially if you look at the polling. And this is a safely blue district. In fact, in 2018, Republicans did not so much as field a challenger to the incumbent in this race.
And she's been, Nita Lowey, she has been in this seat for how long now?
Since 1989, so exactly 30 years.
Wow.
And has never had a primary challenger since that time.
Wow. And so this is about as safe of a blue district as you can get. I mean, New York... I think we still have a couple of Republican holdouts, but certainly not this close to the city. Nyack is not even, 45 minutes, depends on the traffic, I guess, in terms of getting to New York City. But the bottom line is, and this is why I think this race is so relevant to folks who are not from the 17th district, and that is because we need congresspeople who are in the bluest of blue districts to be on the vanguard of doing things like you've been talking about. And give me your sense of like what your experience has been in terms of politics. I mean, you're 32. This is your generation. We sort of skipped mine in a large respects, went from the boomers to the millennials. And I got no problem with that, knowing my generation, with all due respect to me and to my generation. But give us a sense of your experience that you've had at this point, because you've packed a lot into those 32 years.
That's right, and many my apologies to your generation for jumping the gun a bit.
No, thank you.
I was born and raised in this district, was born at Nyack Hospital, raised in the village of Spring Valley, which is a working class district. My political awakening really came when I was in high school, and I saw as a public school student in the East Ramapo Central School District how difficult it was to get, even then, a school budget passed. And I thought to myself, it's really important that I mobilize people. So I reactivated the Spring Valley NAACP Youth Council, got out the vote, registered folks to vote, and a few years later ended up joining the national board for the NAACP and chairing a committee at the age of 19. Wow. I was really active in progressive causes at Stanford University, where I fought for things like faculty and graduate student diversity, a living wage for maintenance and dining hall workers, and even obtained some policing reforms as a senior at Stanford University when the Palo Alto police chief at the time, before she resigned, we got her to resign, made comments supportive of racial profiling. After graduating from Stanford University, where I had been active in student government, I joined the Obama administration. I worked in the Office of Legal Policy at the Department of Justice, where I vetted candidates for federal judgeships and even worked on Justice Kagan's nomination, and also worked on criminal justice reform for an attorney general that actually cared about those things, which I'm very proud to say, and subsequently went to Harvard Law School, where as a 3L, provided free legal services to indigent defendants, folks who could not afford to pay for representation. And I saw firsthand how people are over-arrested, over-prosecuted, and over-sentenced, primarily people of color and low-income people. I then decided to get some of the best training I can get by going to work at a law firm where I also at the same time could pay down the $120,000 in student debt from law school, and where I also spent hundreds of hours investigating claims of employment discrimination and helping people who had been defrauded during the financial crisis get some of their money back. And was very proud to say that I was awarded by the Legal Aid Society of New York for the pro bono work that I did in that capacity. More recently, I founded a nonprofit called Rising Leaders, which provides professional skills to underserved middle school students in three different American cities, in Harlem and in Washington, D.C., and in Seattle. We recently received a grant from the Gates Foundation earlier this year. And more recently, I also worked as a litigator in the Westchester County Law Department, where I litigated some of the county's largest cases and served as a legal advisor to the county executive, to the Westchester County Board of Legislators, and also to the Westchester County Human Rights Commission. And have also been serving at now by leave of absence on the board of the New York Civil Liberties Union. So I'm very proud of the work that I've been doing over the past 32 years. In addition, I've been very involved as an education activist in the county of Rockland in particular, in the school district where I grew up, which is the East Ramapo Central School District, and have been active in the space of criminal justice reform as part of a local organization here.
Well, Mondaer, we got to take a break so that I can try and question what I've been doing with my life after hearing what you've been able to accomplish in such a short period of time. And when we come back, I want to get a little bit more deeply into which issues you would prioritize and where you think right now what the Democrats should be doing in the House, as we are a year away, a little bit more, from the 2020 election. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back after this. Back on Ring of Fire Radio, I'm Sam Seder. Right now, I'm talking to Mondaer Jones about his primary challenge to Nita Lowey in New York's 17th Congressional District. So, Mondaer, you basically walked us through your experience, which, frankly, it took me some time to digest. Incredibly impressive record of activism and education and practice, and simultaneously dealing with the issues that I think are probably at the forefront of at least somewhat in terms of your campaign. You talk about student debt, and you talk about education reform. that you've been involved in working for vetting federal judges during the Obama administration. Give me a sense of, and we should remind people you're challenging a 30-year veteran who's been in the House in New York 17th District. And frankly, it seems like, you know, across the board, and I mean this no disrespect to folks of my age or older, but your generation, what it means to be a progressive today, what it means to come from a deep blue district in a deep blue state, is fundamentally different than what it was 30 years ago. For better or for worse, that is the case. And there is an expectation. If you're not moving forward, then you're going backwards, it seems to me. What would you look for as an incoming freshman? Like, give me your sense of how you see you would fit into a Congress. I mean, one of the things that we've seen with incoming freshmen in the last 2018 election was there have been more, it seems to me, aggressiveness and caucusing by freshmen than we've seen in the past.
It is critical and certainly possible for freshmen such as what I hope to be in Congress to be the lead on so many of these issues. Student debt forgiveness, for example, is a top priority for me. So is the Green New Deal. We are faced with the existential crisis known as climate change. And the idea that everyone in Congress, certainly every Democrat, has not signed on to support that legislation by now is unconscionable to me. We have to make radical action over the next 12 to 15 years. And if not, it's going to be too late. I mean, we've already seen so much of our infrastructure degraded. And the things that we're talking about as part of the Green New Deal, a guaranteed green jobs program with training, trillions of dollars in training for folks who are going to be as part of a transition from a carbon economy to a post-carbon economy, sort of displaced, these are things that we should be embracing. We should be embracing the idea that everybody would have a job that pays a living wage under a Green New Deal. We should embrace the idea that we are going to shore up our infrastructure to withstand dramatic weather conditions. And these are things that I care about because my generation, including myself, is in the process of inheriting a planet that's devastated by climate change.
So the Green New Deal, obviously a massive priority because of the existential threat to the country. I mean, talk to me about your feelings about Medicare for All, where we've heard a lot of different variations of Medicare for All plan. Give me a sense of what you think is the best case scenario from a policy standpoint, and give me a sense of what you think the politics are behind this.
You know, I've had so many conversations about this with people in my district, including folks of my grandmother's generation. And people are concerned. People are concerned about what it means to lose your private insurance. Here's what I support. I support a system where folks get more coverage than what they currently get, where the out-of-pocket costs of people who are part of this Medicare for All system are not going to increase, but rather will actually decrease, and a system where people will still get to keep their physicians and to go to any hospital or medical provider that they choose to go to, and those are my prerequisites for any program that I would vote for, and that is shaping up to be a Medicare for All system, otherwise known as, you know, I think we can call it universal health care, but these are things that people are concerned about, and I think they're going to be satisfied with the care that they receive under a Medicare for All system. And our challenge as Democrats is cutting through the noise, not adopting Republican talking points about how the elimination of private insurance is going to spell the end of the world, which is simply not true. And I think does a great disservice. I was watching the debates recently, like many other folks, and I was so disappointed in some of the comments that were made by people who should know better, I think.
It's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think the folks, to the extent that people are worried about losing their private insurance, it's because they want to make sure that it's just they can go see their doctor. I don't think anybody is going to miss dealing with the copays, dealing with the filing stuff. But, you know, people are afraid of going from the frying pan into the fire. And I think there needs to be a lot of education about what their options are. Give me a sense of what else. I mean, so Green New Deal, single-payer health care, or at least what you call universal health care. Where are you on student debt? I mean, not asking personally. You've hopefully you've worked that off through a legal career. But what is your perspective on free college, debt-free college? Where do you land on that spectrum?
I am a huge supporter of the elimination of the $1.6 trillion in student debt that young people and folks of an older generation are still shouldering. You know, the average debt load for someone leaving college, and as of 2016 at least, was $37,000. It was more like $10,000 in the early 90s. Yeah. And so my generation was sold this bill of goods that if we just went to college and worked hard, everything would just work out. And that's just not true. That's not true. And now we as a society owe it to folks with student debt to eliminate that and to allow them to be participating members of this economy. Imagine having $37,000 and then taking a job that pays you $40,000. I mean, what do you do in that situation? Well, you have to ask your parents, if you have them, to crash at their place. And then how do you build a family? It's not good for our economy. It's not good for civil society. And we need to address it with bold action. I think a student debt forgiveness program has to be paired with free tuition at public colleges and universities, and in addition to an investment in our trade schools and in HBCUs, or historically black colleges and universities.
Mondaire Jones, tell us, where can people get more information about your candidacy?
You can go to mondaireforcongress.com. MondaireForCongress.com. And feel free to make a donation. I'm not taking corporate PAC money, unlike my opponent. And I need all the resources I can get to put together the strongest possible challenge. And I've got to say, I've been so encouraged to hear from folks at the grassroots level on up who are acknowledging that it is time for a change, that we have not been served well, especially in recent years. And you can have great respect for someone like I do and still come to the conclusion that it's time to shake things up a bit.
Mondaire Jones, thanks for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You can find out more about Mondaire Jones's campaign at MondaireForCongress.com. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Sear. We are continuing our interview series with progressive candidates who are running in primaries and sometimes in the generals across the country. This week, we feature Morgan Harper, running in a primary for Congress in Ohio's 3rd District. So, Morgan, you're running for Ohio's 3rd District against primary challenger to a four-term incumbent, Representative Joyce Beatty. Tell us a little bit about the Ohio's 3rd District.
Yeah, so Ohio's 3rd District is a gerrymandered district, a very safe Democratic seat, and just in terms of, you know, demographic makeup, all that. So it's entirely in Franklin County, which is the county where Columbus, Ohio sits, but it actually is made up of, you know, more communities outside of Columbus, Reynoldsburg, Whitehall, Bexley, some other cities. And, you know, it's 30% Black, 11% foreign-born, 6% Latino. So, you know, very, very diverse community, but also one that has seen a lot of the other side of the economic picture that our country is experiencing, and that, you know, for 50% of the people, the economic boom and the economy growing that's happened in Columbus has not hit them. Wages have been fairly stagnant, and that can be especially acute in a state with a minimum wage of $8.55.
Wow. And what of the opioid crisis out in Ohio? I mean, Ohio has been in the news quite a bit, not necessarily Franklin County, but I'm just curious as to what extent has that been taxing the resources of that community?
Opioid crisis is huge. So, you know, even though some of the national stories focus on other parts of Ohio, certainly within Franklin County and within the 3rd District, there are a lot of people that are either experiencing addiction themselves or have family members that have experienced or unfortunately already passed away from addiction. And so that's a big issue. And I mean, and that's one of the things I have on the platform, Medicare for All. I mean, we need to get people treatment and not criminalize addiction, and also get people the resources that allow them to restabilize their lives, having housing that is affordable, having jobs that, you know, identify a path beyond just life in the streets that's going to be economically feasible. So, you know, there's a lot of things that my platform is giving that will help to address that crisis. But yeah, it certainly has hit a lot of communities within the 3rd District hard.
All right. So, you know, we're doing a series essentially of primary challengers to Democrats, particularly with a focus on ones who have, are primarying the incumbent from the left. But give us a sense of what it is that made you jump into this race. What did you see that the incumbent wasn't doing that you felt needed to be done?
Yeah, so, you know, I was born in the 3rd District at Ohio State Hospital. Ohio State is in the district, and I was given up for adoption. I lived in a foster home and was adopted and raised on the east side. And, you know, my family went through a lot, especially early on in my life, but it opened up opportunity for me to get financial aid to go to an elite college prep school, Columbus Academy, that is also in the district, and really showed me, you know, economic segregation, income inequality at a very early age, and set me on the path I've been on to try to do something about that. And, you know, what I had increasingly been seeing in the last year or so is that, you know, what we're doing, the incremental policy approaches of the last 40 years are not working. And we know that to be true because communities in this district have either unchanged poverty levels or formerly middle class areas have slowly deteriorated over the course of my lifetime. And we need to be moving faster. And in fact, there is a movement that's moving with urgency to actually pass legislation that's going to do something about making sure everybody has access to health care, a home, doing something about the environment, you know, these really systemic issues. And so for me, you know, I had to be honest with myself. It's like, you know, this is what I'm about, and this is the movement that's happening right now. And I felt like real people living in this district would support a more progressive platform if given the opportunity. And so we decided to go for it and launch this on July 1st.
So you've been at it now for about, quick math, 3 or 4 months. Give me a sense of how it's going. I mean, I want to move in. Well, before we get there, actually, because I'm really curious about how you grew up and that sort of that dichotomy of coming from a foster home and being adopted, a home life being one where there was a lot of economic stress, financial stress, but at the same time having access to going to a school with a lot of wealthy people. And I'm curious just about that experience because, you know, we've interviewed people in the past where you know, there's been some research on that. I'm just curious as to, you know, how that realization came and how that adjustment was.
I mean, I think it was one of the most pivotal moments of my life. From the moment I stepped foot onto that campus and recognized at age 10 that, you know, I thought everybody was leading kind of a similar type of life. And, you know, by no means was I living in destitute, you know, conditions or anything. I was fortunate. You know, my mom worked in the public school system, so that equals stable job, benefits, union, all of these things that enable families and individuals to weather a lot of different types of financial stresses, but there were stresses nonetheless, right? And then you go into an environment where you see that there are just unlimited resources for kids and families that are never experiencing that type of stress. And it had a huge impact on me. And I, you know, especially when you're adopted, you're aware that, you know, your life could have gone in a lot of different directions and it's not so special you as an individual, right? I mean, it's kind of random how you end up. And so really feeling like this can't be that just because of the zip code you're born into or a school district, or if your parents happen to have money, that you sometimes get science class and sometimes you don't. And then, like I experienced, then you get into this environment where not only are we doing science all the time, but we're going to have a science lab for 10-year-olds that they have access to. And I still remember that moment of getting into classrooms in the prep school and you could hear the fish tanks bubbling, right? And you're like, wow, that was a level of peace and quiet in a classroom that I had never known before. And so, you know, and you didn't have to travel very far. I mean, I think that's the interesting thing about this district, even though, you know, it's like geographically wide, taking up a lot of Franklin County, these areas are not that far apart. So for me, that was a 15-minute drive journey from the life that I had known into a whole different ballpark of existence. And it's these contrasts are so stark and sometimes just very block to block that, you know, you have to be honest with yourself about like, what are we doing here? Right. And how are anyone in this community, are we really saying they're of different value than someone who is that 15-minute drive away? And that was never, ever okay with me, and I don't think that's really the vision of the American dream that we claim to care about.
Being adopted and having that insight about how randomized and lucky, how much luck has to do with the luck of birth, and I guess and just subsequent to that, implicates the rest of your life. It's fascinating. And we should say you went on to go to Tufts. You got an advanced degree at Princeton, and then you went on and got your legal degree at Stanford, and then worked for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Give me a sense of, I mean, that was that must have been, you know, when it was almost a completely new agency. Give us a sense about your experience there.
Yeah, that was an incredible experience. You know, I mean, after the financial crisis, we all saw, right, there are a lot of people, and we continue to see that, you know, we're really hit hard by that, and recovery took a long time and it's still continuing. And so, you know, being able to be part of a federal agency that was actually realizing the vision I have for the federal government, where, you know, it has resources and a mandate to actually get something done for working people, incredible experience. And we did it, you know, $12 billion back to 28 million consumers over the course of on time there. And you saw that it is possible to actually hold companies accountable when they are trying to prey on working people that really just need markets and financial products to be fair without, you know, really having the time to read through the fine print. And so that's what we were working to fight for at the CFPB. And so I started in the Office of Regulation there doing rule writing. I was part of the rulemaking team that wrote rules to regulate the prepaid card market. It was the financial alternative, you know, financial product to a traditional checking account that hadn't really had robust regulation before. And then I served as a senior advisor to the first director of the Bureau and oversaw, you know, payday lending, regulation development, policy development, credit reporting, mortgage servicing, you know, a whole host of things. But, you know, it was it truly is what we should have the federal government do. So that's a big part of my platform, is things like housing, making sure that people earn enough money to live. These are the things that we need the federal government to actually be investing resources into. And this could be, this is something the federal government used to do, but we kind of got to get back on track and recognize that that is the most responsible use of resources for the federal government to be using.
Okay, Morgan, we're going to take a break. When we come back, let's talk about that platform. I think it's one that, from a progressive standpoint, folks will be very impressed by. We got to take a quick break. I'll be right back with Morgan Harper, challenging a four-term incumbent in Ohio's 3rd Congressional District. We'll be right back after this. We are back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now, I'm talking to progressive candidate Morgan Harper, running in Ohio's 3rd District primary. So, Morgan, in the last segment, you told us why you decided to jump in, and a little bit about your history, having grown up in that district and going from foster care into being adopted, and then ultimately getting to, after your education, going to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and developing a commitment to the idea of financial stability. And that's the first point, your plank, I should say, on your platform, financial stability, and specifically the programs of universal child care, jobs guarantee, tuition-free public college, universal income, federal minimum living wage, Medicare for all. Those are incredibly ambitious programs. What's the one that you think, if you had to prioritize one, what would you say is the most important?
It's pretty hard to say. I mean, I have all of them on there, and that's, you know, feedback I certainly got when we launched. It's like, whoa, you know, Morgan, this is kind of everything. It's like, yeah, this is everything, because these are the things that we need, that working people need to be okay. And, you know, like we talked about before, I mean, I've seen what it's like when, you know, families experience stress, when things start to go off the rails a bit, and what it takes to actually stabilize and weather those types of storms. And we're now putting people, individuals, families in positions where they are completely vulnerable to any type of stress, right? And that's not okay. And so how do we fight back against that? We fight back against that by making sure that people are earning enough money to live, that they're not getting sunk by medical costs that everyone is prone to experience. And if you don't, well, God bless you, but, you know, it's problem coming, right? And so a lot of these are systemic things like Medicare for all, universal child care, which is also becoming almost like a middle class issue for people, even people that are earning, you know, fairly decent wages are feeling the crunch of not being able to afford reliable and good quality childcare. But then also we need to think about the realities of, you know, as we work towards these systemic solutions of bottom line, what's happening to people right now. And, you know, we saw at the CFPB that a lot of families, and the research has been done by the Federal Reserve, that a lot of families, individuals, are not able to meet their expenses month to month because of $400 shortfalls in one of the richest countries in the world, right? Mm-hmm. So that's not okay. So that's why I have some, you know, on their universal income, because we need to kind of like plug that gap right away as we work towards some of this more systemic change. So, but, you know, ultimately what's driving my platform is the building blocks of what people need to be stable, and it's not complicated, and we used to do it, and we've got to get back to it, which is housing, earning enough money to live, doing something about the climate. Now, we also did recently add to the platform public safety, addressing how we approach policing in our communities, which has been a big issue in the third district, and certainly making sure that we don't have people dying at the hands of police and through police violence is another important component of making sure that neighborhoods, individuals, families are able to thrive.
And we should say you also support the Green New Deal, which includes at least some of those planks of the platform of financial stability. I also noticed mm-hmm. that you talk about stable housing, which is not something that you hear a lot from congressional candidates. I have a sense of why it's that important. Today it was just reported this week in New York City, over 100,000 students who go to school every day have no homes. And
crazy.
It's crazy. Yeah. Just talk a little bit about your ideas of housing.
Yeah, this was an important one to me to, you know, lead with, because I actually have a bit of a professional background in this. So, you know, before launching this campaign, I was working for an organization called LISC, Local Initiative Support Corporation, that invests in affordable housing. And in that position, you know, I was traveling around the country and seeing the affordable housing crisis that is taking place across America and the accompanying homelessness crisis, to your point there. And really, it's a systemic issue. What is happening in every single major metropolitan area in our country, it is a systemic issue. And that's when we need the federal government to step up and do something about it. And, you know, and locally in Franklin County, there's a 54,000 unit gap for affordable housing. Why? Because housing prices are increasing because the population is growing and the economy is growing, but not for everyone, and wages have stagnated, so people cannot keep up. Affordable housing, affordable for whom? That's a big refrain that we're hearing in the third district. And so, you know, I have on the platform there, part of that is just increasing the supply, making sure that we are producing more housing, but also putting pressure on substandard landlords that are putting substandard housing onto the market to force them to do something about that. And also thinking about national rent stabilization. So the role that federal policy could play in putting some limitations on how much property owners, landlords are able to profit off of, you know, basic necessity, which is housing, as we have more and more renters that are in our market, given, you know, the pressures of outside investors buying property and all of that. So it's just so fundamental, you know, like you said earlier, you know, people that are going through drug addiction, for example, I mean, you're never going to bounce back from something like that when you can't even get a stable home. So right. it's a really important part of anyone's life.
When you announced in July, I think you had told The Intercept that you saw AOC, Ayanna Pressley, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, the so-called squad, as role models. I mean, give us a sense of how you perceive the way that they are exercising and accumulating power, how you see yourself, your perspective on power, and how you would wield it in the context of Congress, specifically, you know, those four in particular, but also other members of the freshman class have been much more aggressive. Both in terms of like progressive policies, but also from a partisan standpoint, than we've seen in the past from Democrats. I want to just get your take on that.
Well, you know, I think what I find inspiring about them and what they're doing is they're driving agendas that are informed by people, by their constituents. And, you know, that's certainly where I'm coming from with this in launching a grassroots campaign that is 100% people driven is, you know, then the mandate you have is coming directly from the people. So you move as urgently as the people are feeling the issues that they're going through. And trust me, when I tell you that in the third district, there are a lot of people that are feeling an incredible amount of urgency around the issues that our platform is addressing and expect our representatives to be doing more. And that's why so many people are coming out to support our progressive platform. So, you know, that once you're there and once I'm there and part of Congress, you're then able, that is what is informing your voice, you know, what committees you're on to address that platform and coming into these positions with a platform that already that people are paying attention to what you're saying and what you're doing and trying to bring that accountability to Congress. And, you know, I think it's a whole different playbook, and this is certainly true for me in launching this campaign. You know, no one from the party said it was my turn or anything like that. And so I enter to, you know, though running as a Democrat and all of that, I'm entering to get things done. I'm not looking to build a career. And I think that's what we need to have more of is people in Congress that are coming with an agenda to accomplish things quickly, move efficiently, and get results for the constituents as quickly as we can. So that's certainly a model that we're seeing now is, you know, people are having more success with, and you're seeing it play out in that there are a lot of people like me that are challenging incumbents and really trying to drive the legislation that we know is going to have an impact for working people and make sure our economy works for everyone.
That's great. And we should say that you've had tremendous fundraising, most of the vast majority of which under $100 in terms of donations, but wildly successful. And people can find more information at morganharper.org, where you've got your platform. And I imagine you're looking for support both in terms of dollars and in terms of volunteers. Morgan Harper, running in Ohio's 3rd District, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great.
Morgan Harper is running for Congress in Ohio's 3rd District Democratic primary. You can find out more about Morgan's campaign over at morganharper.org. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder. We're continuing our interview series with progressive candidates from across the country who are challenging longtime Democratic incumbents. This week we featured Jen Perlman, running to unseat Debbie Wasserman Schultz in Florida's 23rd District. So, Jen, we are continuing our series here on progressives who are challenging incumbent Democrats. Some of those Democrats are actually fairly progressive, but we around these parts think that these primary challenges are very healthy from the perspective of progressives. In your instance, you are running against someone who has been traditionally fairly popular in her district, but nationally speaking, not terribly popular with progressives. You're running for Congress, or I should say the Democratic nomination in Florida's 23rd Congressional District against Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the former head of the DNC. Let's just start with, before we get to Schultz, let's just start with the 23rd Congressional District. Tell us a little bit something about that district. Who comprises it? What's the history of voting? Is this a Democratic district, broadly speaking? What else can you tell us about the district?
It's a very strangely gerrymandered district, first of all. It's very cut up in a way that obviously they've created a safe seat for Democrats here. So it's a very blue district. And unfortunately for us progressives, it does tend to be more of a Biden blue than a Bernie blue. And this district did go for Hillary in 16. But that being said, I think that things are a little bit different here over the past few years. I've definitely noticed a difference in trend, especially an increase in young people that are being very active and participating. And I think that is a big difference down here. But in terms of the demographics, it's an older group. There definitely is a dominant amount of older people. There's a good sized Jewish population here. And it's pretty varied. It's actually a pretty diverse district, with the exception of it's blue.
Right. Okay. So we have a heavily Democratic district, but with a wide range of Democrats, it sounds like, in the district. With that said, tell us a little bit about yourself. You're a second generation Floridian. Have you lived in that district long? What? Tell us a little bit about your background.
Okay. I am a second generation, and I actually was born in this district. Back when, before the district was cut into the shape that it currently is, it did include North Miami Beach, which is where I was born. Now it only has a sliver of that in it anymore. And I was gone for a while when I went to college, but I've now been back here solid for 16 years living in Davie, which is in Broward, but part of the same district that we do connect. We have parts of Dade and Broward in our district. And my background is growing up in a working class Jewish family in North Miami Beach and going to school with the same kids from kindergarten through high school, fairly typical, you know, upbringing. And my background in terms of what I've done is professionally is journalism and marketing. And then I went to law school. So that's, yeah. So I have very deep roots in this district, and actually more so than Debbie does because she's not from down here. But yeah, I've been here forever.
And all right. So you're a hometown candidate, and I'm curious as to what made you decide to run?
Well, I've been watching what's been going on here for this is Debbie's been my congressperson for 15 years. So I've been watching this like everybody else has unfold over the years in terms of the corporatism and the shift to the right and the people that are representing us, but are actually representing corporations. And I've been watching this happen for a long time. And in 16, I was very inspired when she was challenged in the primary, and I actually volunteered on that campaign. And so I've just been very aware of what's going on in this district for a really long time. And I'm just at a position right now. I recently reactivated my law license, and my youngest is 13 and my oldest just left for school. And so I'm kind of in an opportunity. I have an opportunity. I'm in a position now where I can do it, is basically what it comes down to.
All right. Well, tell us about the way you perceive Debbie Wasserman Schultz. And presumably, I mean, if you're running, you don't think that she is doing a sufficient job in representing the interests of the 23rd district. I mean, where do you think that she is falling down on that job?
Actually, it isn't even just specific to her. I generally am opposed to any sort of corporate candidates, period. I personally won't vote for anybody who's taken corporate money. And that is her problem. And it is with many people. It's not just her. But the fact that she takes money from the corporations and the interests that she takes money from and then doesn't do things that are in the best interest of the district because she's answering the corporations, that's my problem. So it isn't necessarily specific to her, although I could tell you who she specifically takes money from and the different things that she does that I find objectionable. But in general, I have a problem with anybody who isn't answering to constituents because they're on a corporate payroll.
Well, specifically, why don't we get into that briefly? I mean, who do you think that and obviously, I think, you know, a lot of people, this is not it's not a terribly controversial position, frankly, the idea that if you take corporate money, chances are you are either beholden to them or already on the same page as their interests. And that's why they're willing to give you money. I mean, it's either going to be one or two. It's either going to be one of those two, or you have to assume that corporations just have no idea what they're doing and they give out money willy nilly. So where do you think in particular Debbie Wasserman Schultz is compromised by some of the corporate donations she's received?
Okay. I mean, two that stand out the biggest to me is one, Big Sugar. So that's one of her biggest donors is Big Sugar. And as such, she has agreed to giving sugar subsidies repeatedly. And she has done things that are in the best interest of Big Sugar at the expense of our environment. So we have this major toxic blue-green algae problem down here, I'm not sure if you're familiar with, that has infested our water. And it has killed manatees. And it is this toxic smell for people that if they live near it, they have to actually wear masks over their faces when the algae is blooming because they can't breathe. Hmm. So, some of it occurs naturally, but it has been exacerbated by industrial polluters like Big Sugar. So she takes money from Big Sugar. So to me, I don't know if whether or not she agreed with their positions before she took their money or if she just does their bidding. But to be honest, I really don't care. It's a conflict of interest to me. Like it just is. And then the other one that's a big donor of hers are payday lenders. And I mean, I support the new legislation proposed by Bernie and AOC to cap it at 15% for interest for people that are doing their predatory loans is what they are. And we have a significant problem with them down here in Florida. Our rates are off the charts and she takes money from them. So that, to me, is somebody taking money from an industry that specifically targets disenfranchised communities and specifically people of color.
Right.
So, I mean, that's a huge problem. And Florida is one of the worst.
No, go ahead.
And then this was something I was just reminded that her second largest donor is NextEra Energy, which is Florida Power and Light. So anything down here having to do with creating solar initiatives or things that would be putting us in the right direction as far as renewable energy, she's not, I don't see her supporting that. I don't see her proposing that. I don't see her taking any initiative on that. And we live in Florida. We're going to be underwater in 12 years.
Right. And not only, obviously, particularly around Miami, are you going to have a lot of problems associated with climate change. One would think that there'd be ample opportunity for solar initiatives in a place like Florida. All right. Well, look, we've got to take a break. When we come back, let's talk about your platform, your campaign, what you think your chances are, and what you think you need to do to defeat Debbie Wasserman Schultz in this primary. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back. We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking with progressive candidate Jen Perlman. So, Jen, in the last segment, you basically outlined for us, you know, the nature of the 23rd district in Florida. You talked about the reasons why you wanted to run and a little bit about your background. Also, you talked about Debbie Wasserman Schultz and her being one of those Democrats who takes fairly sizable chunk of corporate money. Corporations who, you know, look, they corporations don't give money to politicians that they don't perceive can either help them in some way or can hurt them in some way. And they either give them the money to help them or they give them the money to just not hurt them because folks may have an agenda coming from that area that might not jibe with a corporate agenda. And I've taken a look at your platform on your website, gen2020.com. I also know that you perceive your job as a representative to find out what your constituents think. Let's talk about your platform, but I want you to reconcile that, like, you know, how you both respond to what your constituents want. And you said that you are in a very blue district, but one that has a bunch of different types of Democrats, how you respond to what they want, but also promote progressive values. So when we talk about campaign finance, I mean, what extent do you think people are concerned about corporate financing of campaigns in your district?
I think more and more. I think that more and more people are learning about that. And the people that aren't opposed to it generally don't even understand what's going on with it. And when you educate people about that and other things, it's amazing what people actually can realize is in their own best interest when they're told these things properly. So a big portion, I think, of responsibility of being a representative is educating your district. So, you know, when you ask how do you get progressive policies through even when you have a mixed demographic, I think that one of the things you do is you go around your district and you lobby to your constituents and say, here, this is what I'm thinking would be in our best interest. What do you think? I think that could occur as town hall forums. I think that should be a running online. There should be a running online conversation on every representative's page that their constituents can jump on and say what they think about different legislation. With the technology we have today, I don't understand why they don't do that.
Right.
I mean, but then again, I think that representatives could be wearing body cams when they're having meetings during working days. So, you know, what are they hiding? Why don't they give an accounting for what they do? So my thoughts are, as a representative, you can't change everything, but you can at least be transparent about what you are doing.
Let's talk about healthcare. You support Medicare
Sure.
for all. When we say Medicare
Absolutely.
For all, what do you mean by that?
Single payer. Single payer. Absolutely single payer. I do not think that there should be private insurance companies in any duplicative service area that is being covered by Medicare for all. If people want private insurance for things that are in addition to Medicare for all, I mean, I don't know, things, cosmetic surgery, things that people might want that are not, you know, covered, then fine. But I don't believe that there should be private insurance in any way duplicative of Medicare for All.
And give me a sense of in your district. I mean, you said it's, you know, it's a Miami district. A lot of elderly folk go down there, particularly from, you know, up north here and to retire. What, as you go around and talk about Medicare for All, how do folks who are on Medicare now, how do they respond to that?
That's not the issue that we generally push with the older folks because they don't really care about that. That
right.
isn't their concern. A lot of it is either an indifference or there's even this sometimes, well, I had to wait or I got mine and people just have to wait. And so generally when we're talking with people that are older, that's not the key issue that I'm necessarily bringing up with them. But that's definitely something when I talk to other people that is very supported down here.
Interesting. What resonates the most with the elderly folk that you're talking to in your district?
I got to tell you, I generally find that when you talk about things like this place flooding and their grandchildren being underwater and having toxic water to drink, that is something that they can see a little bit more clearly as an imminent need to work on versus giving everybody Medicare for All. So there's that. And then there's the general anti-corruption sentiment. And I find that across every age. That people, yeah, that everybody seems to agree. And I actually even go to Republican club meetings and hear what they think and what they have to say. And their common theme with them is also they don't like the corruption either. So, you know, it's interesting. There's a lot of things we have in common.
What are those things that they what constitutes corruption in that respect? Just they don't appreciate corporate influence, or do they perceive, like, who's doing the corrupting? Are there competing narrative as to the type of corruption and the source of corruption?
I guess so. I mean, I guess there's all levels, but generally to me, if somebody is being beholden to somebody else, then they're not to be trusted in terms of doing what they're supposed to be doing. And then you bring into account, well, sometimes they're taking money from people, but it's called something else. It isn't exactly where it's supposed to be from. Well, what is that law firm and who do they represent? And what kind of relationship do you have with the people that work at this firm? And at that, I mean, I think that all of it roots to the money, but then that opens up so many different doors to so many different avenues where there's just the opportunity for such impropriety.
So, Jen, we have about 2 minutes left here. What do you think is your biggest challenge? Like, I mean, what is it going to take for you to win this race against Debbie Wasserman Schultz? Do you have a sense of how many votes you need? Do you have a sense of what constituencies or what specific parts of the district you need to convince? What is the theory of your win here?
I think really it's going to come down to a ground game. And I think it's going to come down to knocking on as many doors as we can and reaching as many people personally as we can as a team. I think that's what it's going to come down to. But, you know, really, social media now is different than it used to be. There are certain advantages to being somebody that appeals to younger people that I will have in terms of promotion that she will never be able to attain. You know, she's not going to probably ever have a following on Instagram. Yeah. So there's going to be certain groups that she can't possibly reach. So I think there is certain targeting involved of demographics and getting certain people like really enthusiastic about our campaign. But in general, yeah, I know exactly how many votes we need. And I know exactly which areas to target. I mean, this is very strategic. It's a very strategically planned campaign in this district, and it has to be here.
And I assume you're only taking small donor donations based upon what you've told me in terms of your stance of corporate money.
Correct. Well, we'll look. If an individual wants to max out, we're happy to take their money. But we don't take. We only take from individuals, and we won't take from even groups of individuals. So you couldn't get like a whole bunch of gas and oil execs in one party and have them all just max out to me individually and have me do that. So I won't be beholden to any interest or any group.
Well, if folks want to find out more, they can head to your website, gen2020.com. I imagine you're looking for folks to donate, but also you're probably looking for volunteers.
Yes, we are looking for all of the above. I mean, ultimately, we would really love to get monthly donors. We're asking for $23 a month for District 23, but obviously we'll take other amounts of money, whatever people can share with us. And yeah, we definitely want volunteers, and we need volunteers locally, but we also need volunteers that don't live here as far as even just helping with social media.
Jen, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Sure, absolutely.
Jen Perlman is running for Congress in Florida's 23rd District. You can find out more about Jen's campaign over at jen2020.com. That's it for this week's Ring of Fire Radio. Next week, we will look back at more of these interviews from progressive candidates from around the country. I'm Sam Cedar, saying so long to 2019. I'll see you next year.